Hi, everyone. This is Lauren Petrovic, founder of Laurenti New York. Welcome to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. On this show, I sit down with the most extraordinary leaders behind driving responsible consumption and production in the luxury goods industry. We discuss things like market dynamics, product strategies, emerging technologies, and entry into Web3. The pressing need and increasing demand for systemic change to create a more sustainable and responsible industry is a consistent theme. My guest today is not only a creative pioneer of sorts, she is absolutely a woman with such grace, thoughtfulness, and passion in everything she does. I had a blast, and I think you will enjoy it as well. Melanie Grant is an author, editor, stylist, filmmaker, and art director whose journey into the jewelry industry began unexpectedly when a renowned heritage brand invited her to write about an exhibition piece in Paris. With over two decades of experience, Melanie has cemented her status as a leading female figure in the diamond industry, contributing to esteemed publications such as The Economist, The Times, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and Tatler. In our conversation, we get deep into the weeds about the power of jewelry as a vehicle for art and expression, the essence of authenticity in navigating challenging environments, critical inflection points for businesses today, and some of her stories are just incredible.
I was such a strange person in that environment that no one really knew what to do with me. So it's not like, you know, there were other women that I was with who were trying to be super tough that I just thought there's no point. I'm just going to be me. Yeah. The only way I'll survive this environment is to be totally myself. And that's what I did. And over time, people just accept you if you accept yourself as how you are. So trying to fit in doesn't really work in my experience.
As the author of Coveted and executive director of the Responsible Jewelry Council, Melanie offers a glimpse into the world of high jewelry, unraveling the historical and artistic importance of some of the world's most innovative pieces. You can find Melanie on her website, Instagram, and LinkedIn, all Melanie C. Grant. Without further ado, please enjoy this very wide-ranging, insightful, tactful, and strategic conversation with Melanie Grant. How's it going?
It's good. And I'm very excited by this interview.
I'm so excited to talk with you today. We saw each other last time you were in New York a few weeks ago at the symposium, and it was lovely to sit down and chat with you.
Well, I also love the fact that as a person who's interviewed a lot of people, you know, over my career, it's really interesting to be interviewed. It's really quite strange, but nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was great to see you in New York. We had a good time. It was a good symposium.
I wanted to pave the way and start with your amazing journey and where it all started. So taking us back to the beginning, where it all started, can you expand on your story into the industry and how you are where you are today?
Well, I think it's interesting because so many people start from family businesses or they have someone, you know, in the industry. And I had nothing like that. I think my first experience of jewelry was with my grandma, Eileen, who we were great friends. She lived in the countryside in the UK, and she had this phenomenal rose garden. And in the summer, I would go and help her, in inverted brackets, do some gardening. And she would sit and prune the roses. She's a very good gardener. And I would wear all of her best jewellery and just dance, basically, around helping. And for me, it was such a combination of pleasures. To spend one-on-one time with her, you know, she had five children. There was a lot of grandchildren. I was the oldest grandchild. And also she had this phenomenal garden. And it just makes me think as an adult of, you know, the smell of roses, the sun, just joy, just kind of like having the best of times. So I think that's where I associated jewelry in the beginning, because she was the only one who let me touch anything that was actually quite nice. And then as I got older, I went to flea markets in the UK. Camden Market was a favorite of mine, and I bought a lot of silver, you know, that's what I could afford at the time. And so I collected silver. I was quite gothic then. I was quite a goth, bit of a punk. And I used to go around dressed in black, wearing loads of silver jewellery. And then when Nana died, I was bereft because we were very close. And she had cancer twice. Basically, my granddad died. And then she sort of fell off a cliff and had cancer a couple of times, then died. And I remember going to see someone called Keglim Laufer in London and with my friend Tamara. And Tamara was buying something. And this is the first fine jeweler I'd ever actually really come into contact with. You know, I didn't come from any money. My grandma's jewelry was all quite sort of costume. And I remember sitting there sort of in grief while Tamara, I think, was trying to get me out of the house and seeing this ring, which is the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And it was a diamond ring. I'd never really seen a diamond up close. And I saw it and something inside me said, you have to have that. Like, whatever it is, just find a way. So I said to Keglim, how much is that ring? And she told me, and I almost fell off my seat. It was a lot of money for me then. And I said, I can't afford it, but I want it. And she said, you can pay in installments because I know Tamara, I know her very well. And I trust that you're, you know, not going to run off with it. It took me 3 years to pay it off.
Wow.
And she said to me when she gave it to me, this ring will change your life. And I thought, that's a little bit over the top. And I said, why? And she said, because they will know you're serious if you have a serious piece of jewelry. And she was utterly, utterly right. Every time I wore it, people asked me about it. I wore it when I was nervous about things and everyone was just sort of dazzled by it. And I just, to this day, is one of the best things I've ever bought. And then I kind of became a journalist and I worked in lots of different places. And then I ended up at The Economist and Cartier asked me to go and write about an exhibition in Paris. I'd never really written about jewellery up until that point. And I went, and the force of that beauty and that history just knocked me off my feet. And from then on, I just had to write about jewellery, and here we are.
As I learn, what I believe too is when you fall into something that is your calling. A lot of people, especially in our industry, have serendipitous events that has happened to them. And for those of you who haven't seen Melanie's work, she's able to tell the story of jewelry. You've had so many amazing opportunities for creative mediums like writing, speaking, movie directing. And over time, I'm sure you've started to develop this alignment in terms of self-expression. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you feel your personal mission is and how it influences all of these creative endeavors?
Yeah, I think it became clear as I kind of got deeper into the idea of jewelry that I wanted to dispel the barriers, really, to entry. You know, if you don't come from money, if you don't know anything about jewellery, if you think it's too fancy for you, that's wrong.
Right.
Also, I discovered that jewellery was considered to be less than other art forms. So painting, sculpture, the fine arts seemed to be in this hierarchy above jewellery. And jewellery was a decorative art at the bottom. And I totally disagree with that. So a lot of what I've done, a lot of the writing I've done, have been around challenging those notions of hierarchy. I wrote a book called Coveted, where we talk about, you know, the subject, is jewellery an art? And if so, how? And I talk about that in that book. And I do lots of other things. I do a lot of events where I talk about just the hierarchies and the barriers, keeping jewellery sort of at a very low point, you know, in the art space. So yeah, that's definitely a sort of personal mission of mine.
And where you are today, I know you still write often. I remember sitting down with you and I say, what do you do in your free time? And you say, I love to write. What keeps you inspired and motivated in your work? And do you face any challenges today with what's going on from a global perspective of the industry?
I mean, my biggest challenge personally is time now. You know, obviously, as you go on, and you get more known for something, more people ask you to do things, which is a great privilege, but it's also, you've got to be quite careful about time because you can wear yourself out. Right. I wake up every day, I often look at Instagram and I'm blown away by so many different types of design, different types of jewellery, different types of expression. I feel very privileged to be able to document and talk about jewellery in all different forms. I go to, with the RJC, I go to trade shows, I meet members, I talk to artists, I'm on social media, and I learn something new every day, and that inspires me. I think globally, there's lots of challenges. You know, it's such an old art form, jewellery. It's one of our oldest art forms. And it has to keep evolving with the times to stay alive. And so, you know, we have various challenges on the horizon now. We have sustainability, legislation. We'll talk about a bit more about that later. I think the main thing is to just hold on to the joy. You know, it's a transformative vehicle for art and expression. Yeah. And the reason it's still going 40,000 years later is because it's always there when we need it, and it's always what we need it to be, because we reflect, I suppose, our needs and desires onto it. But it's the beauty and the meaning of it for me, which ensures that it will probably be here forever, well beyond us. You know, when we're all gone, it will be somewhere, you know, out there in space probably. So I think I'm motivated by the creativity, you know, in terms of art, but also the fact that it's just still out there and kind of more or less unchanged from its origins, which is fascinating.
Indeed. And I really like what you said about jewelry being a transformative vehicle. The art form itself is so deep and carries so much meaning and is a really powerful communication tool of what's going on today, and something that lasts for generations, which is really exciting. And there's very few objects in this world that are able to do that. So I want to ask you more about Responsible Jewelry Council. Mm. You were recently appointed as executive director. Can you give us a brief overview of RJC and its core mission for the industry?
Yes, so the Responsible Jewelry Council started in 2005 by 14 companies across the industry. So we have the big brands like Cartier, Tiffany and Signet, the miners, ABN, AMRO, De Beers Group and Rio Tinto, and then the trade groups, Jewelers of America, SIBJO, and the National Association of Goldsmiths. And these are just some of the 14 companies that started it. And they wanted to bring the industry together and create standards across the entire supply chain, which didn't exist and still doesn't exist. We're the only ones who do it because it's not easy. So in order to unite jewellery globally, we had to have this shared belief and all agree on it that responsible business is good business. And that has to be core. It can't be a sort of thing you bolt on, you know, to be okay with legislation. It has to be a core belief system within your business. And it's something which the industry needed and still needs today. Everywhere I've been since I've been executive director, people have said, we need the RJC to continue. It binds us all together. In a competitive industry, we can't compete on this one core topic. So it's quite crucial to like the evolution of jewellery in general. Yeah. As ED, you know, it's challenging because to keep abreast of events across the entire supply chain isn't easy. But it's very rewarding because members are very enthusiastic. I travel around the world, as you know, constantly, meeting people and talking to people about this. And it's really encouraging to see new territories, say like Turkey, was in Turkey last year, really enthusiastically wanting to understand and be part of this movement. And then more mature territories like America and Europe, parts of Europe, which have been doing it a long time, but who again want to go deeper into it. So it's, I see a lot of engagement and a lot of enthusiasm.
I see too that RJC is going to be around for decades and decades because, again, you guys are one of a kind in the industry and there's not many other people doing what you're doing. So under your leadership right now as ED, how are you guys approaching Russian sanctions and at the same time promoting ethical practices throughout the supply chain, whether you might be a manufacturer, a jeweler, retailer? What are you guys doing right now to help address that?
It's a challenging environment for a lot of businesses right now. Obviously, there's lots of legislation, sanctions including, out there, which we, you know, all of us have to abide by. and which we explain to our members as simply as we can. We, like some other trade bodies, have issued guidelines. We have training, how you can apply our code of practices, you know, in order to deal with the sanctions and the restrictions. I think our remit as a company is to really have a conversation which is ongoing, so that when something like this happens with, say, the G7 sanctions, we're already started. Because you've already got standards that you're working towards and that you're being audited against, you're kind of part of this. You know, it's not a huge shock. You've got things in place, which is the whole point. So I think we're just talking to all of our stakeholders. You know, we have a lot, members, trade associations, governments, consumers, about getting into that mindset of continuous improvement, because you're already on the journey. So when a piece of legislation hits, you're ready. And I think that is the core key. You know, we're looking at other elements of change as well. The energy transition from fossil fuels to green technology, for example. Yeah. That's another thing that we need to get ready for. And so when legislation comes in around that, you know, we're kind of already working together on it. That's the point really of us as well.
Working in the mindset of continuous improvement is a very good way to begin, especially thinking in terms of sustainability. It's right now used as a suitcase word. It holds so much behind it. At the RJC, do you guys have like a working definition of what sustainability is? How do you guys define that within RJC?
So for us, obviously, the core principle of continuous improvement is, it kind of lies at the heart of it. But everyone's right. Journey is unique. And we believe in starting with small steps, which builds to bigger decisions that have major impact. So climate change, as we saw at COP28 last year, you know, in order to chart your impact, you have to start with the small kind of movements.
Right.
So if we look at, say, the UN, and their idea of it, you know, it's about meeting present needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. So it's not a linear process. It's about improving in a sort of step-by-step manner. So I think our code of practices and our chain of custody both address the journey. And I think our members, we take them through that to meet that journey. The good thing about, I suppose, us is that if you're a big or a small company, it doesn't really matter. Everything's just a matter of scale. So if you want to look at things like human rights, health and safety, product integrity, things like that, you have to just start. Start today. Don't be worried about getting it wrong. And the idea of sustainability is just improvement. You know, if you look at key definitions, the definition of sustainability is probably beyond most companies. This is like unicorn idea. But responsible and ethical practice is definitely achievable. So I think what I'm saying is, understand your journey is unique. Start today and find an element that appeals to you and start there.
So also, traceability is a big topic right now, especially with these Russian sanctions in mind. And I'm certainly invested in getting full-scale traceability for the consumer to have their eyes on how their piece of jewelry was made before it got in their hands. And that also plays into consumer education. At RJC, is there a way that you educate the members on how they can help enhance consumer education on socially responsible jewelry?
I mean, I would say it really needs to start in school. So we do go to universities. We've just been to Warwick, for example, and we've done a talk there for some of the sustainability students there. And lots of people said, can we come and do an internship at the RJC? And hopefully that can happen. We also have been to Cambridge and we've done some training there and some thought leadership with big companies. So we go in at an educational perspective as well. I would love us to teach something in schools, you know, 7-year-olds and up. Because I think that's where the mindset begins, you know, can you do something differently? It begins early.
Yeah.
And I think the key thing is to think about it creatively. It's not just a business issue. It's about creativity. How can you be creative in your thought process rather than just leave it to the designers at the end? So I would love to see a bit more creativity on social media. I would love to see us just talk about it in different ways to reach different types of people. I did see the World Gold Council had a really good film, which they've just done, a documentary called Gold, A Journey with Idris Elba, which I went to go and see, which was really interesting because there are things I didn't know about that. And he's great to watch. So I think everyone can offer something that can appeal to different types of consumers. I think it's all of our responsibility to educate other people, not just mine or yours. Everyone has something they can do.
Yes, I agree with that too. And it also lends a hand in continuous improvement, you know, sharing your knowledge to other people and helping build that sustainable pathway into the future. Thinking about what's going on right now in the industry, what are some effective ways that brands and businesses can effectively communicate what's going on right now? Like, can effectively communicate their commitment to sustainability to their customers and their audience, whether that's on social media or in person?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to remember that it's about people, because brands and companies are basically people. So I think you have to make your message personal. And I think people don't do that enough. I didn't realize until I had a book that I had to talk about. My publisher said to me, can you talk about yourself? I'm like, I'm British. I hate talking about myself. Let's talk about the weather. They said, no. You've got to talk about yourself, because people will buy what you have to sell if they understand who you are and if they want to be part of your universe. I was horrified, but then I had to do it. And it really works. So I had to tell my story like I'm doing now. I had to engage with people on quite an emotional level. And it really is why people create, it's how desire is created, right? So, and that taught me a valuable lesson. I'd always never talked about myself, because talking about yourself in British culture is like boasting, and you're encouraged not to do that. But I realized, actually, if you're going to touch people's lives, and you have to reach out to them emotionally. So I think you have to tell your story in the marketplace with incredible intimacy. I went to a mine last year in Côte d'Ivoire, an SMO gold mine called the Ity Mine. And I met there girls who were going to school for the first time. I went into the sort of bush, talked to some of the community project leaders and talked to some of the communities. And that like had me in tears. Because I think, what would have happened to me if I couldn't have gone to school? I would be a totally different person, and I would not be, you know, learning and education has been the joy of my life. So it really kind of got me. And I have to tell those stories. So everyone has these experiences. You have to tell them. Because when someone says, all mining is wrong, and you say, well, actually, have you been to a mine? No. Okay, well, go to one. Talk to the miners. Talk to the people who live in the communities. And actually understand it. Get onto the ground. You know, some of it's bad, some of it's good. Like everything. There's no... Yeah. Everything has, you know, both. So I think that's the key. You know, have experiences, tell your story. If it's a brand, make it personal, and you will absolutely reach people. And do it on social media, because it's free and it's there and it's a very powerful tool.
And it should be intuitive, but it's just humanizing business. And it should be intuitive.
Absolutely.
It's not always. It's not always.
No, and we're told, you know, to not talk about ourselves when we're kids. I was. We're told to be professional, you don't talk about yourself. But the reality is, we're in the me generation, you know, it's I. If you want to reach people and connect with them, you have to talk about yourself.
It's a give and a take. It's a give and a take. You give a little bit, you take a little bit, and you're able to form that deeper relationship. But you have to be vulnerable.
Yes.
Slightly vulnerable.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard in the beginning, but then... You're totally oversharing within about 10 minutes. It gets easier.
Very true. There was a World Diamond Council article that came out sometime last year, late last year, 2023. You shared a personal experience where Renault newspaper refused to consider your job application due to being a woman, claiming that you would be too, quote unquote, too emotional, in which you responded, everyone is emotional, but some people choose to express it, which is a strength. And tying into what we were just talking about a few minutes ago is the perspective of, you know, being vulnerable, showing your this emotional side and getting personal with people. Could you share more on the significance of what you believe emotional expression is as a strength, and particularly in the diamond business, based on your experience?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, being vulnerable invites people in. So, yes. You know, we've all been in those meetings where you're sitting next to someone, you haven't met them before, there's like a wall, and you can't really connect. And so you don't really know really what to say. I think being a journalist really by trade means that I have to connect quickly with someone I'm talking to. And so I'm quite open and they're open. And then we find some kind of way of communicating, and that comes across. So in supply chains, obviously mining, manufacturing, refining is often most, not always, but there's a lot of, you know, the majority of people are often men. And newspapers was the same. You know, when I came up in newspapers 25, 30 years ago, it was mostly men. I was like a young woman of color. I was like a freak. So, you know, I decided to just completely be myself. I wasn't going to pretend to be like someone really tough. I was just going to be me, because I thought, oh, I've got to lose. Like I was such a strange person in that environment that no one really knew what to do with me. So it's not like, you know, there were other women that I was with who were trying to be super tough that I just thought, there's no point. I'm just going to be me. The only way I'll survive this environment is to be totally myself. And that's what I did. And over time, people just accept you if you accept yourself as how you are. So trying to fit in doesn't really work in my experience. You know, when you are emotional, be emotional. I'm not saying you should be crying in the office every day, but I'm saying if something happens to someone and they're upset, it's fine to be upset, because it's really hard stuff. It's life, right? Life is tough. So I think the trick is to be calm and even, but to show emotion, to show that you're human, that people, you understand what someone's going through. It's fine to be that person. And I think I'm seeing a lot more of a human side as time goes on. When I started, it was very hard to, you know, if you expressed any actual overt emotion, you were considered to be weak. I think that's changed a lot, but society's changed a lot. So I think it just comes down to being yourself. It sounds simple, but it's actually quite hard to do in the workplace. But you still have to be professional, but you have to be you. And people trust that, because they can see if it's genuine or if it's like you're trying to be something else.
Immediately. You know, it's funny, because I was just having this conversation with someone recently, and it was, if you think about people you work with on the day to day, whether that's in the office or, you know, even remotely, these people you're spending at least 40 hours plus a week with, this is more time you spend with your significant other, your friends, your family at home. So it's extremely important to be able to form those solid, authentic relationships with those people you work with, because at the end of the day, that's like your second home.
And you make decisions and you grow with those people. You know, I was at The Economist for 16 years. It was like leaving home when I left, because I'd gone in there as one person, came out as someone else. You know, someone could raise an eyebrow at me from across the room and I knew what it meant. So You definitely, you know, it takes a lot of energy to try and be someone else. You just got to find a way to exist as yourself and not have that work face, if possible, and actually put that energy into your own ambitions and goals. Maybe, you know, you want to do something on the side, you want to write poetry, like put that energy into something creative.
Yes. And the world would be missing someone very unique if you hold that inside.
Absolutely.
So you have an extensive amount of experience in the industry, and you've met so many different people. Looking at the jewelry industry and also to the broader luxury industry, what opportunities and challenges do you see for women emerging in these leadership roles within the space today?
Well, I'd love to see more women in senior roles in the jewelry and watch industry.
Right.
There aren't enough of us at the sort of C-suite level. People tend to recruit in their own image. That's one reason. It's also just getting into the room where, you know, the decisions are being made. being recommended, being put forward for things is not you necessarily applying for jobs formally. At a high level, you get tapped on the shoulder and invited in. So you need to be in those conversations. And that's sometimes hard because, you know, it can be happening down the pub or on the golf course or in the, you know, so you've got to somehow be sort of considered. And that sometimes is the hardest thing for women. And, you know, when you get there, business can be brutal. Some women struggle with that, the brutality of business. Corporate environments are often built for men. If you have children, that could be tough if you have children. I find getting a mentor is a really good stepping stone to a high-level job. Somebody who has done everything that you're hoping to do, you know, like 20 years ago, who knows the pitfalls, who can guide you. I had a fantastic mentor. He changed my life and he's the reason I'm here now. They don't have to be a woman. They can be anyone who will take you on who's at the highest level of business.
Yeah.
So I would say you need help and you need guidance. You can't do it alone, but you also need someone to open a door for you to walk through to get that first job. To get your first high-level job is the hardest one. And yes. it does take a cacophony of people to help you do that. So I would identify the people that you know of, and I would sort of secretly kind of figure out ways to engage them and to help them help you on your journey.
I think this is a really important lesson, and I want to expand on it a bit further and ask for people who are, whether just starting out in their professional journey, if they've been working for 5, 10 plus years, they think of a couple people in mind they would be honored to have mentored them. What are some ways of navigating those conversations? Is it as simple as sending an email or a LinkedIn message, you know, just being open and saying, hey, I love the work that you've done. I'm really inspired by what you're doing. Would you be open to being a mentor for me?
Well, how I did it was that I approached the number two of the person I wanted. And I said to her, can you help me ask them? And she said, yeah, he's wildly busy. He travels all the time. He doesn't mentor anyone. He doesn't have time. But I'm going to find a way to help you ask him. So I would, even the ask needs to be strategic. So he figured out he was going to be somewhere. She scheduled a call and sort of sold it to him. And he got on the phone. He said, what do you want? And I said, I want you to be my mentor. And he was like, I don't mentor anyone. I've got time. And I said, I know. And he said, pitch it to me. And I had to do a pitch, an elevator pitch on the phone. And finally he said, yes, okay, I'll do it. Because, you know, I would see it as a learning curve for me too. And we had a great time together. But I had to be ready to have that conversation. I had to know what I was going to say to someone who had about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I had to be confident enough to really ask for what I wanted. And I had to be likable enough for him to want to spend that time with me because he's inundated with people. So I think you've got to map out what you want and have it ready, because you could bump into someone and just have to have that conversation. But really, you have to identify the person who the thought of them mentoring you sort of makes your heart stop. And you have to get help to even ask them. An email probably isn't going to be enough. They probably get 10,000 emails a day. They don't know who you are. They're not going to probably reply. So you need somebody in their inner circle to recommend they even talk to you. And I think that's where people don't understand how busy people are. I think if you're at a sort of CEO chairman level, which is the kind of person I'm thinking of, they will probably be asked 10 times a week by someone, can you mentor me? And everyone thinks they're the only ones asking. So you really do have to have an in to even pose the question.
Were you prepared to pitch him on that 2 minute phone call?
Well, I kind of, not really, but, you know, I'd always kind of thought, always have a couple of ideas in your back pocket. Interesting people sort of cross your path all the time. You never know. So, no, I wasn't really prepared, but I must have said something good because he said yes. So, just be ready.
I love that. So, I want to change course a bit and talk more about your work at Christie's and Sotheby's and the Science Museum. You've done these collaborations with these organizations, which I think is really interesting to be able to cross sectors, because you hit a very niche group. You hit a very niche audience, which otherwise wouldn't be touched before. Do you see any other collaborations with other sectors worth exploring, such as the art world, to further advance the jewelry industry's initiatives of sustainability and responsible consumption?
Yeah, I would say the only way we're going to get proper change is to by bringing people from different types of backgrounds together. So yes, we had a state-of-the-art jewelry summit at Harvard last summer in June.
Yes.
And we did that with Harvard Mineralogical Museum and the Gemological Institute of America. And that was three of us coming together to do something that not one of us could have done as well. So we had scientists, artists, industry. We had all kinds of people there talking about how we were going to sort of deal with the future of jewelry. And that was great. Yes. And I learned a lot from that. Out of that came data, which we found really interesting. So we've launched a competition called Jewelry Arts 24. We launched it at Frieze last year with Natal Studio and W1 Curates. And we're going to be asking members of the public to create digital art from the data that came out of Harvard. And that is going to go up a gear next month. So we're having more on that next month. So I think it's all about collaboration, but it's not just the same. It's not trade bodies necessarily collaborating with trade bodies. It's people from all different areas, different sectors, different countries, different geographies, different cultures, different everything coming together. Yes. To impart their knowledge and wisdom. And so I see that. I think the art world is totally and utterly in there, as well as industry. It's quite important also to involve science and technology.
Yes.
But anyone who is interested in sustainability is probably the biggest subject affecting all business globally right now. It's the thing that every single business has to know about their impacts, about the SDGs. It's a massive all-encompassing thing about carbon. So actually, yes, you've got the world to choose from in that sense. So yeah, it's just about, again, creativity, coming up with some new ideas to educate, you know, people who don't necessarily even know about it. Because we're in this space, we think everyone knows about it. There are people out there who haven't even have no idea what we're talking about. They're the people we also need to get to.
Yeah, and I think too, going back to the State of the Art Jewelry Summit that you hosted last summer, I thought it was brilliant because the speakers on those panels typically don't have conversations together. You know, you had a climate specialist or a professor working with the climate change and talking about the impact of the energy crisis globally. And it's something that the diamond and jewelry industry don't necessarily, you know, in the day-to-day of our business, there's no, I don't want to say any room to learn or discover about it, but it doesn't really impact the day-to-day. So I think what you said about collaborations with people all over around the world is really important. Could you talk more about the event happening at Frieze with the digital art and the data gathered from the summit?
We're going to open submissions at Venice, the Venice Biennale, mid-April. And yes, essentially, we want people who don't necessarily know that much about sustainability to take part. So anyone basically can make anything. You can make a chair. You can make a film. You can make a painting. You can make a jewel that is inspired by the data and the ideas that came out of the summit. And then we'll have a panel of judges and we will award somebody the prize. And then they will be mentored and represented by Natal Studio. And they will have their piece of art at Frieze next year. So I'm hoping to get wannabe artists involved, young people involved, anyone who wants to make something and really consider what the future holds should get involved. And that, for me, is a great expansion of the summit, but also it's accessible to everyone who can make anything.
I think getting people involved like that is lowering the barriers to entry to participate. You know, I'm sure that's going to be really exciting to see the artwork produced there. What are your views on, you know, talking more about the traceability initiatives and sustainability in response? I know the EU just passed a new regulation with digital product passports, DPPs, I believe going into start in 2026. How do you see that impacting the jewelry business? You know, thinking about your idea of how the technology is going to impact further downstream.
What we're seeing across all business really is an interesting sort of in tandem thing where consumers in some businesses and in some industries are behind business and sometimes they're in front. So a couple of weeks ago, I went to The Economist, had a sustainability week, and I went to that and there were some fantastic talks there. And I remember listening to the CEO of Skoda, and he was saying, I think currently they have 10% of their cars are electric and they would like it to be 70%, but there's not enough copper in the world to create create the actual physical parts they need to get to that. And I think that's interesting because in order to create green technology, we're going to have to do lots of mining to find the critical minerals we need to create this technology. So the irony there is quite interesting for people to say, don't mine anything. I think there are lots of issues here. Technology, obviously in the digital space like blockchain, that's still fairly immersive. It's coming, but it's not completely here yet. In the diamond space, it's definitely being developed. And sometimes regulation pushes that forward, like the G7 import restrictions we've seen recently on the 1st of March. That is requiring a lot of traceability, which a lot of the industry doesn't have. So probably we're going to have to get more deeply into blockchain to get that, but it's not currently necessarily ready. And it has an impact on cost and time, which a lot of small businesses will struggle with. So there's lots of things pushing us forward. Consumers, Gen Z, sometimes, you know, will not be buying jewelry in the future, which doesn't have any connection to responsible practice. But then some people, older people, are happy to still buy things, you know. So it's a combination of things going on. But broadly speaking, we will have to move forward. You know, I can see in the future transparency being, for diamonds, a huge issue. Someone said to me once that it will replace the four C's in terms of importance. I mean, that blew my mind. Yeah. I don't know if that's the case, but I think we're on a road to quite a shift in terms of thinking around technology and transparency, for sure.
I've heard that too. The fourth value of a diamond is going to be origin and seeing if you have that full traceable chain of custody. But to me, I find it to be a great opportunity. If you think of at the retail level from brand or designer standpoint, you know, having the technology to be able to give your customer, in addition to the piece of jewelry, this entire journey, a story of a piece of jewelry, you know, humanize it, see like what's hands it's touched, whether from the cutter and the polisher all the way down to the jewelry manufacturer and the story behind the piece. So you have a very data-rich opportunity, but then you also have this really deep creative component.
And I think we have to be realistic. Yeah, as well. I mean, producer countries, you know, we have to bring them into this conversation. We can't be talking about traceability and not engaging any companies in the global south, which often happens. You know, a lot of the G7 import restriction conversations seem to be completely without the producer countries. This is we have to find a way for everyone to be included. I also think that ultimately, if you haven't got a computer and you're an artisanal miner, which is still a large portion of the industry, whether it be diamonds or gold, you're still on a paper-based system. So transparency has to start at source. And we have to be aware that there's still a vast amount of the industry which doesn't have access to digital technology or the money to pay for, you know, blockchain. So I do think we sometimes think about it because we're here in the West with the tools. But unless everyone's involved, it's going to be half a transparency. So I think there has to be realistic involvement of artisanal small-scale miners as well as people, you know, in London and New York who've got access to things.
Yes, and that definitely strikes a heart chord in me, thinking about these producing countries having such limited local infrastructure, like access to basic things like education, just basic internet, not even having access to a computer. And the diamond industry, I believe, can be an engine for local social and economic growth. And I think it's going to be the large conglomerate brands who have the financial resources to be able to make this change, I think is going to be super important. Because like you said, the technology is here, but unless all stakeholders are involved from the start, it's not going to work. So we really have to get everyone on board.
I think so. I mean, you know, you look at a country like Botswana with 80% of its economy fueled by diamonds. It's very sophisticated setup over there. I went to the De Beers Diamond Conference in Botswana last year. Brilliant kind of conditions, and everyone has a computer and it's very sophisticated. But then you might go to another country where it's not that. So I think we also have to be mindful that in the South, in the global South, there are very different situations in very different places. And so we have to look at each one slightly differently. And that is time consuming and takes quite a lot of understanding on the ground. I think NGOs can help. I mean, the Alliance for Responsible Mining is very good at sort of supporting communities on the ground. I think they're based in Colombia. There's lots of people who can get involved, but the tricky thing is to come together, to do it sort of collectively.
Yes.
So that's where we have to kind of work together, because it is hard, because each country has its own challenges, its own opportunities. But yeah, I would love to see, let's say, more producer countries in some of those deep conversations about transparency.
Thinking of the collaboration standpoint from the industry and getting these producer countries involved, what opportunities do you see, thinking of the industry at large? How can we address future challenges to promote more responsible consumption and production?
I mean, it's a broad church. So
yes,
I think we've got to kind of, first of all, figure out what the plan is and get everyone involved. I have something coming up, which I'll invite you to, which should be, we're going to consider what the options are. We've got to be realistic about what's possible and do it slowly and incrementally, as we said. There are lots of challenges, financial, time-wise, political, institutional, lots of challenges. But it's just about finding new ways to do sometimes older things. So, yeah, it's a starting point, isn't it? Like for us at Harvard, we talked about it. Now we're having a competition. Next year we'll do something else. It's like building on the foundations year in, year out. There are lots of initiatives out there. So, you know, maybe contribute to another initiative rather than starting a completely new thing. Right. Or maybe just ask the people who need help what they need. We're doing a lot of that in the West. We kind of like give a bit of aid and we say, you need this. But actually just ask, what do you want? Because they probably know, and then like work with them to do that.
For small to mid-sized businesses who may not have access to a lot of resources, where do you recommend they start their sustainability journey?
So if you're small, I mean, 75% of our members are SMEs, which a lot of people don't realize. First of all, just start. You can do lots of resources. We have huge amounts of free training and resources that we give away that are on our website. Find an area that you're interested in and start there, I would say. You can join associations. You can join us. I mean, there's a number of associations. The National Association of Jewelers as well in the UK is very good. Jewelers of America. There's lots of trade associations you can join to understand and to connect with other businesses of your scale. So that's quite important. Do a bit of networking. You know, the holy grail really is to be certified so that your business is actually audited. And then what tends to happen when you're certified, for us at least, is that you have access to bigger contracts, because much bigger companies will only engage with RJC certified businesses. So if you're smaller, then you have access to much larger opportunities. And that because your business is ready. You know, you've looked at your human rights policy, you've looked at all the things, and you've got them ready. So I would say, you know, but that can take a few years. So I just say the first thing to do is to be, is to start somewhere you're interested in, work on it, and network with other businesses of your size to figure out what their challenges have been and what you can learn from them. But just, you know, don't make wild claims before you're ready. My whole business is sustainable, because a lot of people do that, and that puts consumers off. I think the main thing is to just begin, like today.
Yes. And you don't have to be a large LVMH brand to
not at all
be sustainable, to be a sustainable brand.
Absolutely not. You can just, you know, you can look at your packaging and decide that's going to be recycled, or you can look at responsibly sourcing your materials. You can look at the chemicals you use if you're a maker. There's so many ways you can start. Just the journey. It is a lifelong journey, like all great journeys. And putting it off, I talk to lots of small players who say to me, oh, I haven't got time, you know, I've got like three kids and I'm really tired, you know. And I go, you know, absolutely, we're all exhausted, we're all doing too much, but you'd be amazed at what you can achieve if you give it like 20 minutes a day.
Yes. Your businesses can't afford it to not be invested in it.
It's going to be
for the long, you know, term,
in years to come, not something that you can just not do legally or even socially.
Certainly. Melanie, you are someone I see as, I told you before, hearing you talk and even just sitting down with you, someone who's just a very inspiring woman. And I think it's because you talk and you express yourself from such an authentic and genuine place. And it inspires a lot of people around you. So someone I definitely would call a creative pioneer of sorts. Thinking, you know, I want to ask, what advice would you give to professionals in high-level roles or even just starting out on who are hands-on in the making and creating in their day-to-day roles, but then also want more of that creative capacity in their work?
You know, I think you've got to not be scared to live your wildest dreams. It sounds like a bit cheesy, but I remember sitting there, you know, thinking about jewelry, thinking I really want it to make it, you know, I really want to transition to jewelry kind of full time. It was terrifying because I come from a background where you have to do practical things. You know, there's no,
right,
you know, there's a lot of people in the jewelry industry who come from money, who have rich partners, who just sort of like go at it as a kind of hobby. I'm fairly obsessive, so I knew that wasn't going to happen. And I didn't have any of that. So I thought, what am I going to do? And I think you just have to make a commitment to yourself to go in and go for it. And, you know, that's quite scary because it involves sacrifice. You know, sometimes if I'm writing, I can't go out on the weekends. I've just got to do that. I've committed to something. It takes time. It took me 7 years, really, as a base to know anything about what I was writing about. So it does take a long time. Give yourself time to actually learn it. Don't think it's going to happen overnight. It might take a decade, but commit and put your energy into it. And, you know, that's when things start to happen for you. But understand that whatever you see on the TV, it's not fast and it's not easy. And that's how it should be.
I think that's very, very well said. If you can visually depict the ideal state for the industry for all to see, I always say, you know, think of a big billboard in the middle of Times Square. What would it say? And what would it convey?
Just do it. But I think that's taken.
We might have some trademarking.
We might be sued. My billboard would definitely have unicorns on it because I quite like magical, mythical creatures. And I think jewelry is a bit like a unicorn in the sense that it's always moving. It's quite mystical in a way, quite magical. But actually, it's probably quite hard being a unicorn. You know, jewelry is... there's an underside to jewelry, which is, you know, challenging at times. that kind of, for me, makes the beauty even more intense because you've had to work for it. And I think it's, yeah, I think the idea of jewelry for me is fascinating. You know, I never get tired of it. So yeah, we could have a big unicorn on the Just Do It tick and then maybe wouldn't get sued. I don't know. Probably would, but yeah. So yeah, just get into it and, you know, do something a little bit crazy and then see what happens.
I love that. I couldn't leave it off on a better note. Do you have any last comments or insights to leave with us today?
No, I've had a wonderful time. Thanks for asking me. I'm having a great time on this journey. And really, as I say, it's all about people and finding something that speaks to you, whether it be a piece of jewelry or a path, and just going for it. And like, you know, really putting your heart and soul into it. And I think if you do that, you can achieve anything.
Yes. Melanie, thank you so much for your time. I hope to have you on the show again soon.
Oh, yeah.
Where can listeners find you and support your work?
Yes, so Instagram is probably the best place to get me. And I'm Melanie C. Grant on Instagram. My book, Coveted, is available on Amazon, but also Fiden, who's the publisher, which is a PHA, Fiden. And yeah, I mean, I tend to be at a lot of trade shows and events. Just come over and have a chat. I'm always out there chatting to people about jewelry. So come and say hi.
I'm going to link Melanie's social down below, as well as the link to her recent book, Coveted. All right, Melanie, thank you so much. And I hope to see you soon.
Great. Thanks, Lauren. It was lovely talking to you, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can catch more Responsible Luxury Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and the Laurenti New York Media page. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at concierge@laurentinewyork, and I'll link that down in the show notes below, or you can connect with me directly on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. Let us come together to transform the future of responsible luxury. See you next week.